for those looking to live outside the box of religious performance and inside the love of an awesome Father, this is The God Journey. It feels like being able to have a relationship with God is akin to winning the lottery. It happens. People do win. But the odds of winning are a million to one. Hi, I'm Wayne Jacobson, and I want to welcome you to this edition of The God Journey. And that line is one of the saddest lines I've ever gotten in an email. We'll look at the rest of the email in just a moment. I think it will lead to a discussion that I hope spawns some conversation among us. I'm going to today try to unpack some of the edges where I'm thinking these days, and it's not clearly formed in my mind yet, so we'll see what comes out. But I do hope it engenders a bit more of a conversation. But before we do that, just wanted to let you know that the folks in Kenya are actively building their service station that we talked about a few weeks ago, and just wanted to put that back on your heart if some of you wanted to send some funds for that. We are deeply into the process now. We've sent over more funds at this moment than we've had come in by a significant bit. And if we're on this alone, we're going to be happy to do it for them. But if you'd like to help us help them, we'd be incredibly grateful. And you can get more details at the bottom of the podcast if you want to help. And over the last few days, and finally this morning, put the finishing touches to what I'm really excited about is a trip to Israel. Now, I know all ministry people seem to take a trip to Israel for some reason. I was in Israel in 1997, and it was not what I expected. I didn't have a lot of expectations about Israel. I don't think God's more present in Israel than anywhere else on the planet. I think God's everywhere people are. But I was surprised at how impactful it was to walk the shore of Galilee, to walk up the steps that Jesus would have walked going into the temple, or to be in the dungeon under Caiaphas's house, or by the rock where Abraham was going to offer Isaac. And it's definitely a land of incredible history and incredible political dynamics today. And I've wanted, ever since I was there, I've wanted to take Sarah back. I've wanted Sarah to see some of the things I saw and experience some of the things I experienced, because it really is nothing like reading scripture once you've actually been to the places where these events unfolded. Because now you don't have just made-up images in your mind, you have actual images. And that makes the reading come so much more alive. And it's also a great curiosity, particularly about the things we talk about, of growing love and trust. Why God chose this place, why God chose that place to make himself known in the world and to reveal his love to the whole world. And so I'm going to get a chance to take some folks there. We're going to limit it to about 40 people because I don't want it to be a huge tour. I'm less focused on the tour than I hope just a group of friends go who can have some conversation as we sort out God's revelation of himself in that part of the world. So if you're interested in going, there'll be details up shortly. Just want to get you to know so people need to book time out of their schedule. We'll be going February 5 to February 16th in 2014. So I know it's a little ways off, but it's never too early to plan that kind of a schedule perhaps. So I want you to let you know that. Love to have some of you go. Love for the conversations. I even am excited about the people that will meet other people, at least from those who've talked about going. We'll see who actually signs up when sign-ups happen. But just want to keep you aware of that. And maybe if you need to set aside a few pennies to maybe make that trip a reality. Don't even have the cost at this point. We're still scheduling all of that. Back to the letter I read you. I read the last paragraph of this letter. Let me go up and pick up a little bit earlier on. It says, first and foremost, I'll take this moment to thank both of you, referring to Brad and I. I got this letter probably back sometime in the fall, for shining as beacons in a tangled wilderness of thoughts, words, actions, dogma, and chaos. Simply said, I had not come across the books and the podcast. If I hadn't come across them, my journey would have been laden with more darkness and despair than I was capable of handling. At the very least, without all these conversations I was able to listen in on, there was a good chance I would have embraced some of the rigid do-good, get-good, do-bad, get-bad God paths. For the past year, I've toyed with at least writing something to you. Why? Because crushingly so, it felt that I was further from a relationship with God than ever. Over the past few years, my thirst to listen to and ponder over the different topics I heard on your podcast and a number of others has been fading. Not because I find fault or flaw in what I heard, but rather I found the distance between me and God could still be measured in light years. You know, on the one hand, I hate email like this because I hate knowing that people are stuck there. On the other hand, these are the emails I love because I get these generally before there's some kind of breakthrough in someone's life. I love the hunger The sense of feeling lost in it all is a big part, I think, of somehow us giving up or looking elsewhere than where we've looked in the past. And one of the things for which the religion that we've come to know as Christianity enrages me is because it creates hungers in people that it cannot fill, for reasons we'll talk about in a moment. He says this, for a long time, back to the letter, I felt that God was the only thing that saved my life. My search for God had ranged full circle. Belief as a small child, tattered and torn as I witnessed the judgment and warfare Christian waged on others outside the circle of belief. Gone as I raged through life as a full-blown alcoholic, and as I began my first tentative steps toward recovery, I read everything I could find about religion. You name the belief, I checked it out. A spiritual experience, I clearly felt, heard, sensed God tell me that everything will be all right, and I veered back toward Christianity. I was drawn to those who spoke with authority. God spoke to them, and if I did the right thing, God would speak to me. There was the problem, though. In AA, I watched and saw that many who had been in the program for years and decades had not grown beyond, I had a crappy day, but I didn't take that first drink. It made me wonder. They were just a drink away from hell on earth, and obviously they'd not healed the wounds that had driven them to drink. That is where Brad and Wayne came into the picture. I can't describe just how transforming and mind-boggling it was to hear the two of you tell of your own journeys. For a season, I was buoyed to new heights. There was a God who loved his people, a God who wasn't striking down folks left and right because she momentarily sinned. But I've become increasingly alone, and to compound the isolation, I've been hounded by a sense that God will strip me of everything. And no matter how hard I struggle to live one day at a time, no matter how responsible I try to be, no matter how much effort I put into trying to devise a way to care for my family, it is all to no avail. Listening to your podcasts had less and less meaning for me, more and more like it felt you were speaking of something I was never going to encounter. I've run endless spiritual miles. I've searched countless spiritual havens. And it just never gets closer. And since there's nothing I can do or say to drive God away, I've tried to leave all the doors open and the welcome sign up 24/7. The results thus far, more has been stripped from me. I am far more aware of just how alone I am. To put it another way, it feels like being able to have a relationship with God is akin to winning the lottery. It happens. People do win. But the odds of winning are 1,000,000 to 1. Wow, Jim, first of all, I want to say to you, if you're still listening to the podcast, don't even know that you are, but thanks for your letter. Thanks for your honesty. And this is where my heart breaks. It breaks because Christianity promises people a meaningful relationship with God, but then it can't provide it. And that's not a slam against Christianity. It's just the reality. It cannot, not will not. Cannot. And I think that's what many of us at various stages, all the emails I've gotten from doing this God journey over the years, there's so many people in religious systems, in Christian systems, hearing promises, having hungers tapped, even having experiences where God makes himself known to them, and then trying to redouble their efforts and try to find a way into that reality, only to watch it fade away and to feel isolated and alone, just like Jim does here, and then trying to find another way to make it work, and trying even harder, maybe at a different place, and again being disappointed that it's not what it claims to be. And then in the midst of those things, we feel the futility and frustration of trying to work a system that can't do what it promises. Now, this is not a diatribe against all Christian institutions. As I said to you last week, that's a place where my hunger for God was tapped. It's the place that began to nourish a hunger it couldn't satisfy. But like many of us, there's just moments of coming to grips with the fact that this isn't getting me where I want to go. I was at a funeral last weekend at the fellowship I pastored at 30 years ago. Long time, 35 years ago. And I met people there that I knew back in the day. And what was sad to me, spiritually, many of them are just in the same place. And not that they're bad Christians, they're good Christians. Very conscientious people, very well-intentioned people, work very hard, been committed, spend their life serving the institution, hopeful that their relationship with God would connect. And I don't know that most of them are disappointed today. They kind of swim in the sea of just stagnation. I know because I hear in their voice the things they hunger for that they haven't settled in their heart yet. And then I wonder, why is that so? As I watched the new Pope installed in Rome a few weeks ago, and I did watch it just because I'm intrigued by that whole thing, but when I see him sitting in that, if you watched it, there's one point where before the Mass, he's sitting in this canopied throne at the top of the stairs to St. Peter's. And the image of this ornate throne and the Pope sitting on it, and it's all covered in this red velvet, crushed velvet red canopy, or so it looked, with gold trim. What has this in common with Jesus Christ as he appeared in? How did Jesus and his disciples, even after 2,000 years, how does it get there? How is that recognized as the pinnacle of what religious authority is? And I know a few of us on this podcast are going to say, well, it's not that for me. And I agree with you. It isn't that. But it is regarded as that by so many people. And then there's this letter, and I want to read it. It's from Eleanor in Europe, and that's a made-up name because I just didn't know if she wanted to be exposed for what she wrote to me. But I want to read this to you. I was sitting in my kitchen praying and seeking the Lord's heart. Suddenly, I found myself in another place. I was standing inside a house behind a wall, and the Lord was right behind me. And I was close enough to hear what was said in the room next to me. There was much laughter and a wonderful atmosphere. It was around 10 adults and some kids enjoying themselves running around. It was obviously, this was a gathering in the middle of the day where people had some time off. People were dressed in their everyday clothes, some in their work clothes. One by one, they shared their life with Jesus. They all knew who he was, some more, some less. They were used to being around him. It was people that were his, and he was there amongst them. And there was much respect for the sharing of each life and the teaching he individually had given. And the atmosphere was filled with real love and real joy, and so I wished I was part of it. And amongst them, I saw a person whom I knew had the heart of a shepherd. I saw how he watched the people gathering, loving each one of them, pouring out his love for his people. And I was amazing. I heard the Lord saying to me, "This is my body. This is my church. They know me. They walk with me as their head." And then I was in a new place. It was a large building. I saw a pastor on the pulpit, and I saw people stoned upon their chairs. And the words of the pastor sounded loud and wise, but it was without his life at all. And the Lord said to me, "This is not my church. There is such a difference in the people's hearts from the first place and the second. In the first place, they knew the Lord. They leaned up against him, enjoying his life. He owned their hearts. The second place, they knew the pastor, obeyed the pastor, the elders, and whoever was in charge. The Lord was there, but the church's authority was far more important." Then the Lord said to me, "I will destroy the so-called church made out of buildings. My church is not a box, and it has no limits. It moves in freedom. My church is not forms and regulations. My church is not control and fear. My church is not pastors' sayings and doings. There will be a change in people's understanding of what my church is. My church is gathering where everyone has something to add because they know me. I'll be the head in each one, pouring my life into each individual." Then I was back home. The time I saw this, I was part of a little church, and the Holy Spirit began to show me the truth of what was going on. He revealed to me the condemnation, manipulation, favoritism, and control. The pastor was able to control the people present with her eyes, and they were all scared of her trying to do their best. What I saw was a congregation back in the chains they had been set free of, and it was awful. And so she ended up leaving it, and then she writes this, "So I lost all my friends overnight and was totally on my own, all the people I cared for and thought cared for me as well. Everyone was gone. I'm still on my own following Jesus every day." Wow, Eleanor, I think many of us have come to similar discoveries. I think what I want to say to you is you're part way down this journey. It's the middle of a chapter, not the end of it. There's still some things for you to recognize, but it's caused me to step back a little bit because so many of us have been through a process like that. We engage the life of Christ by learning what it is to be good Christians, and we got involved in something that we thought was one of the better expressions of that Christianity in the world, and worked hard at, whether we were in leadership or just part of the flock, doing what was expected of us, hoping that that would give us the relationship we got with God that we wanted. And yet something stirred in our hearts that didn't quite fit. We felt the frustration and futility of a system that at times couldn't love the way it needed to love, and we struggled with what that meant, and confused by the fact that Christianity has the truth at its core. For the most part, it does. The truth is there. But the living of the truth is not. It's lived out in a system that actually undermines the reality And what I hope to talk to you about today is actually there's a reason for that. So we begin to wake up. Things don't fit here. We just read part of Eleanor's waking up, and it happened actually in a dream where some of her vision, where some of her passions and frustrations become true. The contrast between what real fellowship would look like and what a regimented group of people living in fear look like, and hoping that there's an opportunity for people to live life in Jesus in a way that's meaningful. And how many of us have come to that awakening and done exactly what she did? She just feels like she can't go there anymore because it feels like it's an affront to the deeper work going on in her heart. This is part of what I think the awakening is. The yuck factor we talked about a few weeks ago, that's what happens. Whether you're in leadership or part of it, there's something you just can't keep doing. It feels yucky to do it. And then the decision is, and I know many people who've been at this crossroads, it feels yucky to do this, particularly those whose living is made by cooperating with that system or whose ego is satisfied, whether it's a music gift that needs to be up front or whatever. You've got something that gift, that system provides for you. That's the most dangerous place. Because when you have the yuck factor, and we all had it, even as young Christians, I think there were times we had it. And we'd ask questions, and people would tell us, well, how would you know better than we know? Why don't you just shut up and go along? This is how God's asked us to do things. And then we did. We went along, because what else are we going to do? Do we really know better? Shouldn't it be different? And maybe it shouldn't. And then the frustration grows. The futility is worse. We ask questions. Sometimes we're marginalized. Sometimes people, even those things that kind of started out as more relational entities, suddenly there's people around that want control of the thing and are going to help the thing survive at all costs. And in the beginning, at least for me, and I think this is common to a lot of journeys, our first thought is, wow, I wouldn't make the same decisions the leadership's making. So maybe the problem here is the people. Maybe we had different people involved. I've talked to so many church planters who have given me their vision for what they want to do. And usually it's very relational, and usually it's very much in sync with things I've said or written. So they're thinking, yeah, I'm going to champion that. And then I'll look at them and say, how many pastors do you think start fellowships with that exact vision in mind? And almost everyone says, I don't think anyone does. Oh, really? So you have a vision that no one else who started anywhere on the planet who started congregations hasn't had? I don't think so. And what I say is I think 99% of them have. No one started a church, planted a church for it to become a machine that chews people up. No one starts there. Almost everyone has a passion to help God grow, to have a more authentic environment. And then once they begin to go down that system road, they find the system doesn't work so well. And so the first thing is, well, we just need different people in charge. And then we get to be in charge. And then we find out being in charge isn't the answer, because it still's got all the same frustrations and struggles. I had someone in my home a couple of weeks ago, and every time I think of this person, I have remembered a lunch appointment I had with her and her husband many years ago when I was pastoring. And we needed them to fall in line in a certain way to help us out with some leadership things. And they had something else on their heart to be involved in a different way than we wanted. And so I took them to lunch, and my job was to kind of get them to make the choices that would help us as a group best. And boy, I've looked back on that kind of, at the time it felt very loving and right. And I mean, I was doing what needed to be done. But I think if I was really honest, I'd have to say there was an awkwardness to it and a yucky feeling. Kind of, if you remember the story I told you about making rules in Sarah's garden a few months ago. And Sarah said, don't you make rules in my garden. And I'm only doing it for you, darling. And particularly with the grandkids, she said, the one thing I want is my grandkids to enjoy my garden. And whatever they do in here, they can't possibly mess up something I can't fix in a few minutes the next time I'm back in the garden. And it was eye-opening to me because, you know what, I don't want to be the rule maker in Sarah's garden, particularly with my grandgirls, because they don't think it's fun when I'm making rules. And I've learned not to make rules. But when Sarah's language, I heard her talking about God and how often I've made rules in God's garden. Not for me. I was doing it for God because people were doing stuff that wasn't quite right, and I could get them to do the right thing. Wouldn't that be better for us all? And I remember this conversation. She was in my home a couple of weeks ago. I don't see her very often now. She was here for my birthday party, and And her husband has since passed away from the time. But we sat down at the table, and I said, you know what? We had so many good times back there. She said, yeah, we did. And I said, you know, there's one thing. She goes, that lunch appointment. You remember it. She said, oh, I distinctly remember it. I said, you know what? Every time I think about you guys, I think about that exchange. And I've always wanted to tell you, I'm just sorry. Would you forgive me for that? And we just had the chance to laugh and celebrate. I don't think I was a bad guy. I was trying to do what I thought was best, but at first we thought, well, there must be something wrong with the people, and then we get to be the people. And then we frustrate with the system, as we did, and tried three or four different incarnations of systems. Then even when I spilled out of it, then you try three or four different versions of more relational systems, house church, organic church, and the like. And yet every time we started to go down a road, they'd reach a point of the yuck factor where I'm just going, I don't know that I can keep going on here. I can't. And so we'd shut it down, and yet there's that drive. Well, we've got to be doing something. What is it that we got to do, and how do we do it? And I think so many people, and we talk about a greater gathering from a few months ago, I think what tips in people's heart is finally we're going to have something we can do that's going to produce what we want. And I think that's the human inclination. It seems since the dawn of time, and our failure in the garden, whether it goes back to the Tower of Babel, or it goes back to David's need to build God a palace called a temple, and God saying, I didn't even ask for one, to Jesus coming and say, tear down this temple, and I will raise up a new one, to Stephen being about to be killed. And he says, for God does not live in buildings made with hands. And the word buildings is not specifically talking about edifices, facility. I mean, we always think about that going, okay, well, you know, God doesn't live in cathedrals and the Holy of Holies and the temple and, you know, all that's kind of a facade, even though we keep building things and calling them God's house. But the idea of man-made realities is something bigger than that. It's man-made constructs. And since the dawn of time, it seems we've had this necessity to find a system in which we can replicate the life of God to people. Or a model we can follow. And it doesn't matter what system you use. The fact that it's a system means we're in control of it trying to get to God. And I think what God's been waking up the reality to, where I experience real community right now with people, hasn't a system involved in it at all. It's just people who love God and know how to love each other. And any attempt to put that in a system, even the thing we called friends and friends of friends last few years ago, back in Ireland, 100 folks from all over the world. And I had a letter from somebody this last week recounting those days and what it did for their lives that 100 people from 14 different countries could gather together for a week without any program other than the fact that we're coming and we're going to be here. And all the amazing things that God did just because people who knew him we're relating together in an environment that allowed that to happen. And I, to me, that's the joy of this journey. We keep trying to find, first of all, the right people to manage the system, and then we find out, wow, it isn't even the right people. What if Galatians, the book, what if it wasn't about Judaism versus Christianity? What if it was about law and systems and human effort versus people who live at the pleasure of God in the world? And I'm beginning to think that's what it was. That I don't care if it's discipleship or community, the fact that we put it in a human system, listen to me carefully here, doesn't make it evil. I think that's part of the confusing thing about Christianity. Most people's hearts in it start out right. They want good things. They really want people to grow in Christ. It's not that we're dealing with, yes, there are a few cultish things and authoritarian controlling things that really are about manipulating people. Some of those even think they're doing God a favor by doing that. I think that's clear. But most of them, well-intentioned people. In fact, I just had lunch today with a local pastor. I met a couple of weeks ago. We wanted to get together. Great time of conversation. I love what he hungers for, and he's struggling with, does it fit into this modality? And I'm not the one to tell him, I don't think so. I think that's got to be a discovery he makes. But what I'm wondering is our attempt, even if it's organic, house church with the church worker who's got the authority to lay down the model and people have to follow. Because here's part of the problem. The open church thing, gosh, was that 20 years ago when people were talking about the open church? And even Eleanor referred to it in her letter. But just let it be open. Everybody gets to share what they want. Well, people who tried open meetings and had a lot of people in the room who didn't have a clue what God was and who he is, and the people that grabbed the microphone were people that just needed to have the limelight, and people that really hungered for God got really turned off by a lot of that and just kind of moved away from open meetings, not because they didn't love open meetings, would have loved it. But as one man said, if our open meetings is just pooled arrogance or pooled ego, what good is it? And man, I think that's true. And so somehow whenever we try to figure out a way to get together, if you just let it be wild, then what usually happens is the wrong people, in the sense that they don't have a heart for what God says. They don't even know God yet. And so they're trying to turn this thing into something of their own pleasure, and that turns other people off. And so then we struggle with, how do we preserve this thing? So how do we manage what the group becomes? And we start that by naming it, whether it's the system we name. See, because I think the building made with hands isn't about brick and mortar. It's about human systems, principles, ways to follow, ways to do it, that people can follow the way of doing it without following him who is the way. That maybe what the Church of Jesus Christ in the world is, in God's view, isn't applicable to any system at all. You just can't find it. And the moment it becomes a system, even if it starts out with people who really love God and want him, the moment it becomes a system, you've laid the lines, you've laid the foundation for it to die, for it to have to preserve itself and hurt people in the doing it, because no system can truly love people and set them free. Systems, from the very beginning, are about conformity. And I think what Stephen was saying, I think what Paul is saying in Galatians, I think what Jesus is inviting us into when he says, I am the way, is that you don't need a system. And I'm not saying, well, Wayne, you're just advocating for anarchy and independence. I like what Joni said last week. And I know she was quoting another author, but a couple weeks ago on one of the comments, she talked about grace to the old man is nothing more than an excuse to sin. But grace to the new man or the new woman, what God's created in you that thrives, it is the greatest invitation into the fullness of life and transformation. It's not at all. It depends on, you know, what creation you're a part of. And I guess what I'm kind of concluding is, our systems of religion, even our more relational systems, read organic church, house church, whatever, the reason why those falter, and I tell you, I've been in those places, I've talked to people who lead them. To lead a network of house churches takes an awful lot of work to sustain it, because it's still an it. And you're bringing people together who may or may not know God as Father, and if they don't know God as Father, then you've got to manage that, or it becomes a bit of a mess. That there may not be a way to do it other than the way Jesus did it. I'm going to hang out and love people and let people connect with people and see what God does. The church takes form in the world out of the relationships of people who are living inside God very differently. And the reason someone like Jim, whose letter I wrote to begin this podcast, the reason that people like Jim can be part of this thing for a long time, try to find their way into a relationship and still feel a million miles away, and that the relationship with God's a lottery. See, I don't believe that for a minute. I don't believe that what I'm experiencing isn't available to every other human being on the planet. I believe that it is. If I thought it was unique to me and I just happened to win the lottery, I wouldn't do what I do. I wouldn't put things out there to frustrate people. I would just enjoy it quietly. The reason I've done a series like Engage, the reason we put transitions up, the reason I've written the things that I've written, is because I want people to know this is not a relationship you can figure out and fight your way into. This kingdom is incarnational. It begins with what God does. It begins as God begins to reveal himself. And as you learn to relax into that reality, and yeah, that takes some time, that takes some encouragement, that takes some unlearning of the religious ways we try and approach God and the ways we look for him when he's not there, the way we think he should be there. When we relax into a reality and go on a journey that's alive and transforming, that's relational and will only be relational, and you can't systematize relationality. That's where I'm coming to. You can't do it. And so we've ended up with religious systems, even Christian religious systems. And here's what's so confusing about them. There's a lot of truth there. There's a lot of well-intentioned people there. God can even make himself known there. But all the time, energy, effort we put into sustaining that system or gaining advantage from that system or benefit from that system takes us outside the new creation and makes us part of the old creation again. It's the old nature that seeks those places, whether it's control over people or the desire to be controlled. It's back to Israel wanting a king, just to be like all the other nations of the world. And we do the same thing with our religious passions. We want to be like all the, we want to have somebody tell us what to do, a program I cooperate, a ritual to follow and find comfort in the ritual. God's inviting us into a relationship with him that's so much more vibrant than that. The building not made with hands is we've got to take the risk that Jesus is who he says he is, that he does make himself known, that he does invite people into himself, that he is the head of his church, and he can connect people as he desires. And as we learn to live freely in him, we'll begin to see him make the connections that he's already trying to make, but we're just missing because we're trying to do it our way in the way that makes us comfortable. If we're going to be the Church of Jesus Christ going forward in the world, I love it. I think we're going to learn to lean back and realize, wow, you can't work a system and help people find life in Jesus. I can't work a system and find my life in him. Oh, I'll taste him. I'll see bits of him. But then when I try to make that systemic, it will fade away. It always fades away. I'll never forget this comment that a pastor of a very large fellowship made to me a few years ago. He invited me to come, loved, he loves me, wanted me to do a thing for his staff, then wanted me to talk to the church about it, really captured by the message. And as we were talking through why he wanted me to come, what his hopes were, what he was dealing with, in a moment of honesty, this is what he said to me. He said, the closer I walk with Jesus, the harder it is to pastor this church. Now, you know me, I love statements like that's pretty counterintuitive. What do you mean? He said, what I mean is this. When I'm close to Jesus, I can't manipulate people the way I need to make this thing work. Wow. I came to that point. I can't. And now the crossroads is, so do I stay a little more distant and do what I think I need to do to earn the living or to get the ego strokes that I need from being ahead of a successful system or institution? Or do I walk away to find out what loving Jesus would mean in terms of how I would treat people? And the problem is, whenever humanity amasses a significant amount of money or influence or property, and systems are notorious for doing all that, once you do that, you've now appealed, I think, to the old nature in all of us, which, and I heard somebody describe it in the publishing industry this way, it's always going to be about cash, credit, and control. Who makes the money? Who gets the credit, the ego strokes, and who gets to have control over other people? Cash, credit, and control become the predominating influences of our human systems. If we keep them smaller, is there less of that? Yeah, I think that's true. That's why oftentimes when a new group begins, the first years of people learning, sharing, growing, loving, it's good. But the more it goes on, the more cash, credit, and control, and being in charge of those things becomes important to be in the spiritual leadership to keep order and maintain a propriety of life together. You see, I think there's a different structure in the new creation. It's not no structure, but it's not systematized by human conventions. God doesn't live in systems created by men or women, for that matter. Sorry to be so old English here with using it generically. God doesn't live in systems.
God lives in people. We're the temple of the Holy Spirit. And if we follow Him, this is why it's not anarchy and independence. God's going to, here's what I know. You know the Father I know. You know the Jesus I know. He's going to connect you with people. Some who are well on this journey, who encourage and sustain you. Some who may not be on this journey at all. And you get to love them and watch them as God opens up a journey with them. But He's not looking for us to create a system, nor is there even one that won't in time end up serving itself instead of the kingdom in the world. When I was a pastor, I used to thought what was good for this church was good for the kingdom. That's amazing. You look back now going, wow, that was so not true. And what I had to do to get that to work, and even in the end, what I had to do to stay was to treat others in a way I just couldn't do. I couldn't. It wasn't in my heart to do so. And that took us on a different journey. I want people to go on that journey. Is Jesus really the head of the church that He says? If we walk with Him, will He not knit us together with people, not only locally, but even translocally? And yeah, He does. He will. He'll do that. If we can resist the urge to create a system out of it, put a name on it, write books about it, sell it to people so that people can follow our system instead of following Jesus. That's where I think the yuck factor is so important, to come up against those moments and go, as much as I'd like to go there, I can't go there. And yet it's hard. The pastor I'm with today, he's saying some wonderful things. There's some great freedom that awaits if he goes down that road. But I know his unanswered questions, because mine were, his unanswered questions are going to be the things that trip you up. If I go down that road, what's going to happen? And the answer is, you can't see it from there. You just got to go. This is an unfolding reality. And when you awaken, when you are yucked by things, don't make the people evil. Don't go attack the thing, because it just, you're wasting your time and breath. Go on the journey. Because God is bigger than all that stuff. And even when I said about Christianity as a system, God still makes Himself known there. He's still there. He's still working with people. There's some of this reality of relationship that gets bigger than the system. Inside all of those things are probably most of them. People who connect, who love each other, who care about each other. But then they'll keep running up against the futility and frustrations of a system that, under the guise of serving the kingdom, is only serving its own survival and longevity, and in that sense, it cannot long love, and it cannot teach people to live in the freedom of that love. That's what I'm thinking about these days. I think its implications are huge in how we think about this body of Christ going forward, how we live in it. Rather than creating a system that gives us some sense of permanence, we live in the reality of the church as expressions forming here and group of people connecting and life happens. And even if it's just for a week in Ireland or if it's longer around where we live, but let it be for what it is and not try to make it something it isn't, and entrust the work of the Father to a human system that will always fail it, will always leave us frustrated in the end. So what do you think? Love to hear what your thoughts. I'd love to process this out more and see what we'd learn about the way the structures of God in the world are not about building systems. They're about love, in honor, preferring one another, serving each other, caring for each other, watching how reality leads us into the fullness of His life.
For traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com,